Welcome to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
Survey after survey has shown employees to be happier, healthier, less stressed, enjoying spending more time with their families and saving a substantial amount of money on not commuting, eating lunch out, etc., etc. But crucially, these surveys have also shown most people to be equally or more productive than they were when working in the central office.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, and generous support from Lane County and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Hello, welcome to the City Club of Eugene, September 17th, 2021 program. The next normal, flexible, adaptable, visible, the future of working from home. I'm Kitty Piercy, the City Club president. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, and we invite you to become a member of City Club. Our programs are always available to you on our YouTube channel and Facebook page. We also have a podcast, which is available on Podbean, and programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 on Monday nights at 7. In today's program, we welcome Francis Hollis of the London Metropolitan University and Howard Davis from our own University of Oregon. Biographical information on our speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. And thanks to Karin Knudsen for coordinating today's program. The next normal, flexible, adaptable, visible, the future of working from home. The abrupt closure of office workplaces was a visible and dramatic response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, millions of people continue to work from home as our unexpected global experiment continues. And recent surveys show that neither the workforce nor company executives want to simply return to pre-pandemic routines. The next normal for work includes expanded flexibility that has the potential to better support workers, families, and local economies, and to significantly reduce waste, pollution, and stress. The benefits of this change are potentially transformative. The future of work, one that is more flexible, adaptable, and visible, requires the reconsideration of our housing and the participation of our neighbors, and it asks us to rethink how design and policies can better support home-based work. Our speakers today include two international collaborators from the Workforce Project, a research group that studies the tolerance, flexibility, and creativity needed to make future cities and economies more resilient. Architect Francis Hollis from the London Metropolitan University and Professor Howard Davis from the University of Oregon.
Good afternoon. I'm Francis Hollis from London Metropolitan University, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak here today. Events that truly alter the course of history are comparatively rare, but it seems that the ongoing pandemic may fall into this category. Watching it unfold, as someone who's been researching the architecture of and urbanism of home-based work for 20 years now, has been fascinating. There seems to be widespread agreement that COVID-19 has irreversibly changed the landscape of work. We've known for a long time that most people like working from home, mainly because it increases the control they have over their lives. The really big shift that has happened as a result of this global experiment in enforced home-based work, however, has been in the bosses' perceptions and attitudes. Survey after survey has shown employees to be happier, healthier, less stressed, enjoying spending more time with their families and saving a substantial amount of money on not commuting, eating lunch out, etc., etc. But crucially, these surveys have also shown most people to be equally or more productive than they were when working in the central office. So suddenly, home-based work can be seen to make good business sense, especially in the context of the huge reduction in overheads that is made possible by getting rid of surplus office buildings. This is potentially a win-win situation. While some employers remain desperate to get back to normal with everyone commuting to work, they're in the minority, and most are shifting to or planning for a hybrid approach that combines working from home with working in collective workplaces. This has profound and radical implications for the way that we inhabit, think about, and design our buildings, neighborhoods, and cities. Because for more than 100 years, homes and workplaces have strategically and systematically been kept separate at both the architectural and the urban scale. Almost all housing built today is designed around the limited domestic brief of cooking, eating, bathing, sleeping, bringing up children and watching television, nothing more. And it's often regulated to prevent or prohibit home working, while our cities are governed by largely monofunctional ordinances. In the context of the COVID-triggered surge in home-based work, this raises major questions, particularly about the future of residential suburbs, high streets, and central business districts. What has just happened with this massive global shock of a pandemic can be interpreted as a paradigm shift. For a century, the built environment has been designed and organized to keep home and work separate, and we now need to find ways to reintegrate them. My research into design for home-based work has two areas of investigation at its heart, the first involving researching precedents. The building type that combines dwelling and workplace has existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years in every culture and every country across the globe, but has previously been little researched or written about. A long and distinguished history can be traced of these dual-use buildings, which I call work homes, from the medieval longhouse, through the weavers' and artists' houses with their tall volumes and big windows, to the briefly popular but ill-fated live-work units of the late 20th century. Many were designed at the scale of the urban block, not just of the individual building, as urban quarters that accommodated blue-collar workspace. Knowledge of this lineage can contribute to an understanding of how to design well for this working practice today. Similarly, historic cities across the world, designed as walking cities before the time of cheap transport, interwove home and workplace to create a fine-grained mixed use. 17th century London is a case in point, where women and men worked side by side in their homes, often living above their shops or workshops, surrounded by their elders and their children. And a jumbled juxtaposition of big and small, smart and tumble-down buildings meant that rich and poor were also close neighbours, providing a model for urban inclusivity in stark contrast to most contemporary urban neighbourhoods. The second aspect of my research has involved investigating contemporary home-based work. Who are these people? What work are they doing? What buildings do they inhabit? And what are their social, spatial, and environmental needs? I've made a close scrutiny of the lives and premises of more than 200 home workers in England, Japan, the Netherlands, and the USA, initially working with 76 urban, suburban, and rural UK home-based workers from across the social spectrum in an unexpectedly wide range of different occupations and living and working in astonishingly different building types. This has resulted in a series of typologies and a set of principles that underlie good design for home-based work. So, how can we transform our buildings and cities to meet the needs of a suddenly enlarged home-based workforce? A central finding of the research is that one size does not fit all. People work from home in a very wide range of jobs, from professionals, such as bankers or architects, through service industries, such as hairdressing or childminding, to the creative industries, including artists and musicians, or craft occupations, such as joinery, furniture making, motor engineering or dressmaking. And they live in radically different households, not just nuclear families. In general, the middle classes accommodate their home-based work through under-occupation in a spare bedroom, an underused dining room, a disused garage, or a shed at the bottom of the garden. People from deprived communities inhabiting public housing, however, disproportionately represented by people of colour, rarely have this option, either because they don't have any spare space or because the sort of work that they do may be prohibited in the home. And the COVID infection and death rates reflect this. An important underlying principle, therefore, when thinking about how to design for home-based work post-COVID is to acknowledge and attempt to mitigate such deeply embedded social and spatial inequalities and injustices. Buildings and cities used to accommodate home-based work across every sector, and they can do again. The research is clear. Good design can maximize the benefits and lessen the undoubted disadvantages of this working practice. Three guiding principles emerge from 20 years' research into this field. Our buildings and cities need to be designed and governed to maximize their flexibility in use, their adaptability over time, and the visibility of the home-based work being carried on in them. People like to work at home in radically different ways. For example, some like to keep the home and the work aspects of their lives totally separate, while others don't distinguish between the two at all. Some like to work in silent isolation, while others like to be part of a busy, noisy working environment. And our buildings and cities need to start to reflect and accommodate this. There are four basic variables: the type of work, the makeup of the household, how much space they have, and the personalities involved. Simple design strategies, such as making functionally neutral facades and volumes, neither obviously domestic nor commercial, and also providing two separate entrances to support dedicated work and home realms, especially helpful where the work involves interactions with members of the public, make a difference to how flexibly people can use the spaces they have. And spatial needs change over time. Families and households grow and shrink, and so do businesses. But people don't necessarily want to move every time this happens. Embedding adaptability as an underlying design principle into our buildings and neighbourhoods allows for change of this sort, thereby increasing people's agency over their lives. Houses are generally intrinsically more adaptable than apartments, as side, rear, or attic extensions can usually be built with ease. But a creative structural design can contribute to the future adaptability of apartments, allowing inhabitants to reconfigure space to suit their needs, as do ordinances that facilitate the frictionless change of use of a building from residential to commercial and back again, as in Japan. Finally, home-based work needs to become visible in the neighbourhood to reduce social isolation and problems with occupational identity for home workers, to increase the eyes on the street, making neighbourhoods safer, and where a home-based service is offered, whether it's childminding or ironing, accountancy or psychotherapy, joinery, web design or music lessons, to build local social networks and strengthen the local economy. For decades, people have been working in their homes covertly, either because they fear they are or because they actually are breaking some regulation or other. Local, regional and governmental policy has a role here in developing a culture in which this working practice is openly supported and encouraged. Simple strategies like permitting modest signage, including oversized windows onto the street so home workers can see and be seen, and creating collective courtyard or garden spaces that encourage neighbours to get to know each other, bring home-based work into the public realm. As I said before, this is a paradigm shift. This change in how we inhabit our buildings and cities has happened abruptly as a result of the pandemic. It will take time to adjust the way we design and govern them. There is immense scope, however, for the home-based work-driven 24-hour inhabitation of homes and neighbourhoods to bring new life to our buildings, our streets, and our local economies. What happens next will largely depend on political will. It remains to be seen what response there will be to this challenge and opportunity. Thank you. Over to you now, Howard, I think.
I'm Howard Davis. Thank you very much, Frances. And thank you, Karin, for the invitation to speak. I'd like to follow up on Frances's talk by shifting the focus to the United States and to Eugene. In my book, Living Over the Store, I wrote about some of the reasons that zoning ordinances eventually resulted in cities with highly fragmented land uses. While zoning originally served some important functions of keeping noisy and polluting industrial uses away from places where people were living, it also was co-opted to help lock racism into cities, partly through the separation of different housing densities from each other. And it led to the development of land use patterns that have helped exacerbate the use of fossil fuels. It takes a long time to correct such mistakes. For example, it's only now, almost 70 years after President Eisenhower signed into law the construction of the interstate highway system, that the Biden administration is proposing in one of its infrastructure bills the expenditure of money to knit back together some of the urban neighborhoods that were severed with freeway construction. And even if the relevant bill passes both houses of Congress, which is of course not assured, much of the damage is done and irreparable. Now, the pandemic is forcing us to question some basic assumptions about what cities are like. Zoning ordinances, New York's in 1916, Portland's in 1924, Eugene's in 1935, with its first major modification in 1948, were one way of expressing ideals concerning everyday life and lock those ideals into law. These ideals include the idea that the house is for family life. Activities that bring in money for the use of the family happen someplace else for the most part. And furthermore, different parts of the city are associated with different parts of the economic and life cycle: making, selling, consuming, learning, healing. Although variations of these ideals exist, they're often difficult to attain because of our ordinances, because of the structures of development and planning, and because of the societal pressures that maintain these ordinances and structures. Since it's become clear that the pandemic was bringing these ideals into question, there's been much written about which way things are moving, and there's not by any means uniformity of opinion. Some write that most people will go back to the office when the pandemic subsides. Some write that most people will remain working at home. Some see half and half. Some emphasize the movement to suburbs and or smaller cities and towns. Some people emphasize the physical decentralization of large companies, and on and on. In addition to different interpretation of what's happening, there's also conversation about what should happen and why. Being in the same physical space is important to the culture of the office, or Zoom is a great equalizer, or working at home is good for family life, or working at home is bad for family life, or something else. To the extent that we are at a point of inflection, the idea is not to support one or the other point of view, going back to the office or continuing to work at home. As Francis has mentioned, and as our work home project has often stated, one size does not fit all. But saying that is not enough. We need to recognize that the values that have guided and controlled the design of our cities for the last century or so are no longer appropriate for everyone, if they ever were. The major changes in societal structure that are coming to be recognized as critical to mitigating climate change, to countering social inequality and economic injustice, and providing freedom of opportunity, are also implicated in the seemingly simple question of where people work and what is the nature of the home and of the neighborhood. And it's not a matter of either or. Instead, it's a matter of people and businesses having the freedom to do what's most appropriate for their own situations and their own lives. Policies, laws, and development practice, and ultimately the ideals we maintain about the shape of our cities and the built environment in general need to change from a particular image of the world to ways of living together that's one of respect for people and their circumstances, for different ways of working, for different varieties of family life, for different ways of starting a business, for some people who want to go to work and others who want to work at home, for a range of working models that companies might adopt, for an understanding that because of their occupation, many people simply cannot work at home. The city that results from this change of attitudes will be more representative of human and economic variety than our cities are today. It will much better exhibit individual and community control and participation than cities do today, and it will allow life to proceed, giving people and families the opportunity to live and work in ways that are most natural to them. The city of Eugene is in a potentially fortunate position with respect to this question. The current work on increasing housing density, according to HB 2001, the new state law, is a start, but it also represents an opportunity to extend the conversation beyond housing itself to include other ordinary activities of daily life. A neighborhood in which housing density increases without other kinds of uses may defeat one of its own purposes by increasing car use or keeping people at home when the increased density might suggest a more active life on the street. We should think not only about making ADUs easier to build in Eugene, but also ACUs, accessory commercial units, which are becoming part of the discourse of 15-minute neighborhoods. When I first moved to Eugene in the 1980s, there were small grocery stores attached to corner houses in many places throughout the older parts of the city. There are many fewer of those today, but they're arguably more needed and perhaps more viable in neighborhoods of higher density, where they could add to active neighborhood life while also decreasing automobile use. When I was teaching in Portland several years ago, a couple of my students did a survey of houses that had shops added to their fronts. Many of these additions happened in the 1920s on larger streets that had streetcars and are still in use today, many of them with businesses run by people who live in the connected houses. Over Labor Day weekend, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Portland, and while the downtown still has a way to go in regaining its life post-pandemic, the neighborhoods were alive and active with people on the street enjoying restaurants and cafes, and they suggested that the mixture of dwelling and work is something to be encouraged and not made difficult. Our zoning code already includes a provision that permits home occupations in dwellings under certain very limited conditions. And in one of Eugene's neighborhoods, the Whitaker, a zoning overlay allows for a wide variety of uses and activities. So there are already a couple of important starts. I would very much like to see a conversation within the city that might be understood as the local version of the national and international conversation that's happening about the nature and location of work, and that dovetails with the important local questions of zoning changes in residential districts. That conversation might begin with a series of questions. Are we in the best situation to be able to innovate in our contribution to that conversation? Do we know whether the laws that are already on the books are allowing for the variety that should be present? Can the home occupation provision in Chapter 9, our zoning ordinance, be modified to make the business more visible and therefore more of a part of neighborhood life? Are there people and families that would benefit from a rethinking of those laws? For example, those who would like to start businesses at home, but who can't for reasons that can be corrected. Or those who operate businesses under the legal radar and who should be allowed to do so legally. Are there neighborhoods that are particularly appropriate for relevant zoning changes and others less so? How can this happen in ways in which problems that many people can foresee, problems of noise, of traffic, of parking, might be mitigated? Can we learn from the way that other cities connect parking requirements to the proximity to public transportation? Might different neighborhoods have different needs, different opportunities that would result in different homegrown tweaks or overlay zones? So I'm not yet advocating a change to the ordinance to allow for more home-based work, but a recognition of it as a potential issue and a close look at how that issue might be dealt with here in Eugene. For about 100 years or so, a particular social ideal about the location of work in relation to home has guided policy, zoning, development, and consequently the form of our cities. That ideal is now being questioned, and it seems important to ask those questions in knowledgeable ways and to ask them in places like this city where the answers might actually result in meaningful change. Thanks very much.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our YouTube channel and our social media pages.